Well, wonderful to be here. Good to see all you guys. Tonight, we're in Ezra chapter 1 and 2, which is lesson number 2. And just preview of coming attractions, on Sunday we'll be doing lessons 3 and 4, because we have 15 lessons in the set. So we're going to double up on one lesson in Ezra, double up on one lesson in Nehemiah. So we'll be doing lessons 3 and 4 on Sunday, Lord willing. All right. So one of the most important things in these kind of books is who, what, where, when, and how. And I want to add something to the end of that, applications. So in chapter 1, the who and the what and the where. Who is it? Who's leading the expedition back to Jerusalem?
Zerubbabel.
Because Ezra hasn't gone yet. This is Ezra talking about what happened. Okay? And what was the approximate time that this expedition was led?
What year?
Or you can just take the date they were deported plus 70, right? It's around 636-ish. They're coming back, all right? And where were they, and where were they going? This group of people.
They were
in Babylon. Going to Jerusalem. Now, we'll talk about later on how many people went. But let's just think about that. They're traveling almost 1,000 miles. And how many people actually went that were recorded? Ballpark.
50,000.
About 50,000. So let's take the Braves Stadium, fill it up, put 7,000 people in the parking lot, and let's say, okay, we're going to Chicago. And we start walking. Can you imagine how arduous that would be? How hard that would be? And if you read in the context of how many mules they had and how many horses they had, it wasn't a lot. And those mules were probably used for, you know, a walk-in warehouse. So they're on this journey. They're going through hostile territory. But what does the chapter start with that makes it all possible?
Cyrus.
Okay. So what do we know about Cyrus?
King of Persia,
yep. Do we know anything about him from outside of these two books?
He was foretold that he was going to achieve God's purpose for them.
Right. Jeremiah said that what was going to happen to Cyrus?
He's going to rebuild the city and free his people.
Mm-hmm.
Basically.
For what reason, though? Why would he do that? Mm-hmm. But why would Cyrus make this proclamation? What brought that about in him? God stirred him up. Absolutely. So one of the things I want to think about as we go through here is what are some obvious signs of God's providence right here in these first few verses? We see Cyrus being stirred up by God. Whether that was through a dream, whether that was through God speaking to him directly, whether it was through a person we may know of called Daniel, who could interpret the dreams he was having, I don't know. That's God's end of the stick, and I'm not going to whittle there. But God stirred him up in some way to make this happen. What are some other obvious signs of God's providence in these first few verses?
Well, in verse 5, it says that God stirred up the spirit of those who volunteered to go.
Okay, absolutely. They were given the encouragement and the spirit, either that's through the prophets or through something else. But they were also stirred up as well. What else is an obvious sign of God's providence?
Cyrus says he's charged by God to build or to rebuild.
That's right. Absolutely. And what's very interesting is who was in his palace at the end of his reign? Starts with D.
Daniel.
Means with an annual.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So amazingly, Daniel survived regime change. From the Babylonians to the Persians. And you'll see Daniel's language in the things that Cyrus said. Because if it weren't for Daniel and or his friend's influence, Cyrus wouldn't have known these things. He was a pagan. He was a local god individual, small g. Okay, well, what are some other signs that you saw?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we see the willingness of the people. That's the last few lessons.
Okay.
So that's, I mean, you see these obvious signs of God's providence. And what I want to get from that, or apply from that, is God is still in charge of all the nations. God is still providentially working today, in my belief. Some may argue that, but God is still working in our lives through His providence and through other people. So I think that's one thing that we want to make sure that we emphasize from this. What were some of Cyrus's accomplishments based on other things we read in the scriptures?
He was the founder of the Persian Empire.
Okay, he founded the Persian Empire.
Babylon fell to him and fostered him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what's really interesting about that is when you read the language that he uses, it's very similar to that language that the Babylonian king used many years before, right? When he, Nebuchadnezzar, when he went out as a wild animal. Here's the rest of the lessons you don't have the back half of. Oh, sorry. Come on in. There's the back half of the lessons. Good to see you again. So he recognizes the God of heaven, and that the God of heaven gave him all these kingdoms. Now, where would that come from? How would he know that? I mean, it has to be the influence of Daniel and other believers, right?
Go ahead. Yes, not that it's biblical by any means, mm-hmm. but if you've ever seen any of the pure books movies, the book of Daniel, mm-hmm. their interpretive angle on that is, it's Daniel late in life, and he's sitting around the campfire telling Cyrus about his whole history. Mm-hmm. Cyrus is asking all these questions. So I thought that was mm-hmm. interesting from that. You know, from that movie's perspective on how Cyrus knew about all these things and how he knew about the God of heaven.
Right.
A lot of it could have come from Daniel.
And what's really interesting is he describes the God of heaven in great and glowing terms, based probably on Daniel's influence and other Jewish people's influence, but he still has God in a view of the God who's in Jerusalem. So he doesn't have a full understanding, but that's okay. God can use the people and the nations of the world even if they don't fully understand how it's happening. So I think that's very interesting to observe as well. Anything else you guys had in that? Things that you brought out that you thought were very interesting?
So I guess it's not really clear whether Cyrus himself was a true believer in Yahweh. I mean, he had this policy of, you know, whoever you
right.
are, you know,
right.
it was very multicultural. Go back where you came from, worship your God. But even installing a leader of that mindset, mm-hmm. who he viewed as a providential blessing from God,
sure.
because, you know, God's people benefit from that viewpoint.
Yeah. And what's really interesting is if you look at the book of Daniel, he read about the 70 years. Mm-hmm. And you also see the people now going, it's 70 years, something's going to happen here. Because I think a lot of critics have said, well, 70 is just a complete number and that kind of thing. But they seem to think the 70 was a real 7 years. So I think that's very interesting to see. So what mission does Cyrus give to the group returning to Judah?
Rebuild the house.
Okay. All right. Now, as David mentioned, this is something that the Persians seem to have as a... Oops. Not through yet. That the Persians seem to have as a policy. But do you think it's providential that this occurred right as those 70 years ended? Do you think God was controlling all those things and His providence to make all those things happen in terms of kingdoms coming up and kingdoms going down?
Yes.
I believe so. I believe so. And I believe that you see the parallel accounts with Daniel reading about the 70 years. And then you see the people here sing about the 70 years. I think that just shows God's providence working in the background. And oftentimes, when you look at the Old Testament as a whole, you think of all of these evil, awful, idolatrous, bloodthirsty, dreadful people that were doing God's will to bring His Son into the world. You think about the Greeks. Alexander, awful guy, killed lots of people. But when the fullness of times came, there was a language for the world. You think about the Romans, awful, dreadful, bloodthirsty, dreadful people. But the Romans built roads through the entire kingdom, through the entire empire. They didn't build them so the word of God could spread. They built them so they could go and kill people. But that served God's purpose. And we can kind of see God's providence in all these things as nations come up and nations are waning. Yes?
I just think that it's a simple way. God, this is a promise to them that they would return.
Mm-hmm.
After 70 years, and he always keeps his promise.
That's right. That's right. Even if we don't see how it's going to happen. Very important.
You know, not only did he seem to, you know, lead them towards rebuilding the house of the Lord, but he seemed to want to bring it back to its splendor that it was, with all the furnishings and vessels and things he was providing.
And we'll talk more about that too. That's great. So Cyrus tells them, go up, build the temple. Does Cyrus say anything about rebuilding the city at all? Is there anything in his declaration about rebuilding the city? No.
No.
What was he focused on?
The temple.
Rebuilding the temple. And why was that so important to do first?
Even Cyrus would have thought that the nations are led by their gods.
Right. Because if you have the hearts of the people and their religious devotion of the people, then that makes it much easier to have a cohesive group. And Cyrus understood that from a pagan standpoint, but obviously from the worship of the true God, it makes sense as well. So he understood that. And what's really interesting is he said, go up and build the house of God, but what else? What else was everybody else supposed to do?
Contribute to it.
Okay. They're supposed to contribute to it. They're supposed to give to it. And what's really interesting, as we develop the book a little more, we'll see that this giving was demanded of a lot larger audience and a lot larger group of people. So we'll see that that's God's providence. However, God wanted the people, his people, to be involved in the financial support of it. And why is that important? Why is that important? Because in essence, as we'll see later on, Persia gave them a blank check. But why is it important for the people and us today? Why is it important for us to contribute to the work of God?
Participation suggests ownership. Part of you. You're investing in something.
Right.
That matters.
Yeah, exactly. You're involved. And you're committed. It's like the old argument between the chicken and the pig about who's more committed to breakfast, right? The chicken's involved, but the pig's committed. So, God wants our hearts, number one, but God also wants our hearts to drive us to do other things that will help one another. And it also means that, let's say the Persians gave them 2 million drachmas, and all I could do was 10 or 15. Does that make a difference to God?
Yes.
Absolutely. I could win it with 2 mites.
Right.
Her gift was as important to God as those who gave very deal. So that's a good application for us. We need to be involved. We need to contribute our time, our money, our thoughts, our prayers, our devotion, so that we'll be more involved and more knit together. So I think that's very important. And what I'm going to try to do as I go through is kind of weave applications in so that I don't lose them at the end. So you can call me on that if I don't do applications every couple of minutes. So what does God do to support Cyrus' accomplishments? Cyrus did a lot of good stuff, but how did God support that? Absolutely. But what was the reason given for Cyrus's great success? What's the underlying purpose? Was it just that Cyrus was a good guy? God wanted him to rule the world? Or what was the reason for it?
Yeah, ultimately, it was the promise of a remnant.
Right. Absolutely. He was given success so that he could send back the remnant, which was God's purpose. And what's really interesting to think about is, as you go through that, is oftentimes, you know, world leaders will become very full of themselves and see, you know, look at all the great things I've done. Look at all the great things I've accomplished. Nebuchadnezzar had that problem, right? Look at this great Babylon I've made with the strength of my might. But Cyrus was given all these things so that he could fulfill God's promise of the 7-year return and the Messiah coming back. So, anything else you guys want to add to that?
I have a question.
Yes,
how
ma'am.
How did the transition have worked between the previous empire and this one?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question.
Going up a year, it just says just a year into his reign, he's doing all this.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess he would have known beforehand, but he still would have been king. Like, how would the transition? I wasn't here.
No, that's a good question. So what happened was Babylon was the ruling power of the world. And then Babylon became very prideful and very full of themselves. And they eventually took the articles of, that were taken from God's temple and taken away to Babylon. They had a drunken feast with those articles being used. And they didn't know it, but at that time the Persians were right outside the city. And they diverted the main river that went into the city. And so instead of the river running right up against the wall, they could go in underneath the wall. And during this drunken feast, they could take over. And so the Persians took over from the Babylonians, you know, like without firing a shot, they said. And so that's how they came into the position of being a world power, just by God's providence and by Cyrus being a good engineer to divert the river and so forth. So. Does that answer your question?
So they would have, at that point, he would have met Daniel, and Daniel would have taught him about God, or at which point would he have known that he was part of this?
They would probably have gotten the archives from the previous empire, because they established the capital in the same city. So they would have had the archives, they would have known about the ruling class, and they would have known about this Daniel from the previous probably from the previous regime, that he could interpret dreams and had, you know, was able to talk with God. So I think that's how they got that information. It's a good question. Very good question. And, yes, Dan, you had something?
Yeah, I would just say one of the things that they did, this was a common practice for that period of time, is that they would not change much of the government, much of how things were run. They might change individuals who might rule. But as far as rule of law, the way the economy was running, they would leave it pretty much the same, because the less disturbance would be, the more resources and more effort to reestablish that city or that province or that government. And so they just had a thing handed to them on a silver platter, where when they walked in, very little had to change other than them understanding who was in charge, what people were doing, what was the rule of law, and they just ensured that that stayed status quo.
Yeah, there, I mean, there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, obviously the Persians had a different view in terms of resettling people than the Babylonians did, but I'm sure a lot of that was very true, and they brought in some of the other people. One thing I forgot to mention earlier is very interesting, and it comes up, and we can talk some more about that. Does that give you what you need?
Thank you.
Okay, so one thing that's also very interesting that comes up to be very important later in the book is that when they made the proclamation, they wrote it down. And the proclamation was in the royal archives. And when a rule of the Medes and the Persians is made by a king, what can you do about that?
Nothing.
Sometimes you'd hear people say, well, this is the law of the Medes and the Persians, which means this doesn't change it. So they not only made the proclamation to send the people back, but they wrote it down. And that comes up later on when they have to go look for it. What's that?
You see that in Esther.
Right.
The decree had been sent out to destroy the Jews. He had to send out another one to counteract that. I mean, they were still in existence.
Right.
But you could defend yourself.
Right. So that's another thing we see in God's providence, that it was written down and put in the archives. All right. So, what happens with these articles that were taken from God's temple by the Babylonians, the previous empire?
Cyrus gives them back.
Okay. Now, let's think about this. You are the ruling party in the world, Does it make a lot of sense for you to give gold back to people? I mean, gold was basically the currency, you know, that people, that was what gave you power and what gave you influence back then, and now too. It's the only, you know, international currency. But he gives these articles back to them. Why do you think some reasons might have been that he did that? Because it's very non-logical.
The last time they used them, it didn't turn out too well.
Exactly. He went back in the archives and said, remember that feast you guys had back then? That didn't work out so well. So what we're going to do is we're going to take these things and we're going to give them back to those people, and then they can deal with it. Why else might he have given them back to them? Just speculate.
Maybe kind of fear of the Lord, because he said that he commanded to build the temple. And the scripture says that which is in Judah.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows that the temple should be in Judah.
Mm-hmm.
All these articles belongs to the Lord. So maybe kind of fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's great. And go ahead, Dan.
Part of it would have been cooperation. This would have helped to accelerate their ability
mm-hmm.
to restore that national religion back
mm-hmm.
home.
Sure.
Because they're going to use not just those articles, but they're going to use the Book of the Law. They're
mm-hmm.
going to have access to Chronicles,
mm-hmm.
which gives them a lot of information about how they're going to restore, not just how they're going to use these utensils, but
mm-hmm.
all of their worship, all of how this was supposed to be done,
mm-hmm.
who was supposed to be priest,
right.
All of those things.
Mm-hmm. So it was basically, as our brother Rodriguez said, could have been fear of God, because he said, God gave me all these kingdoms. And the converse of that is, God can take them all away.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if it was just a fear of God from, as you guys mentioned, that they heard the last time this happened, it didn't work out so well. Or it may have been that he had read the archives of Nebuchadnezzar, saying, and Belteshazzar, who was actually his descendant, who had the drunken feast, and said, We don't want to mess with this God of Jerusalem. I don't know all about him, but I know, and I can, you know, I know that he gave me all these kingdoms, and he can take them away. So I want to do everything I can to support the people and to win his favor and his eyes. What else did you guys have about that?
Well, I was just thinking that if he wanted to, when he takes them back, like they're going back to build the temple
mm-hmm.
for their worship, these were articles that they might have needed.
Sure.
You know.
Absolutely.
To help them, you know, establish that worship again.
Right. And if you were traveling 1,000 miles and trying to reestablish a temple, how difficult would it be to regain this gold and regain this silver and regain these things? He was just trying to give them a leg up to get started on this, I think so. And obviously, I think he had a great fear, whether it was godly fear, as one person mentioned, or just plain fear. He understood the God of heaven was powerful, and he understood the God of heaven needed to be handled carefully from a world nation standpoint. Anything else you guys have, David?
It might also be partially providential that Nebuchadnezzar didn't destroy it. He didn't melt it all down
right.
for his own purposes. He put them in the house of his God.
Right.
Whatever these articles were, probably enough artistic value or whatever
mm-hmm.
would be perceived as, hey, we can use these things in our pagan worship.
Right.
Even though for 70 years that was a little uncomfortable that the Lord's utensils were being used in that way, but they were preserved.
Right.
So that now at the time of restoration,
mm-hmm.
they can be given back and reconsecrated.
Mm-hmm. Another example of God's providence. Absolutely. Yeah, Dan.
Yeah. So that's a great explanation, because I have a question out of that.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that was utterly destroyed when they were taking all these articles out of the temple
mm-hmm.
at the very end, when Zedekiah was taken
mm-hmm.
off, and this was the end, is they took down the two bronze pillars. And Jeremiah makes special note of the fact that not only were these things removed, that there was so much bronze that could not be weighed.
Mm-hmm.
it says they cut it up in pieces.
Hmm.
They had to take it back in pieces.
Sure.
Things were like 75 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
These things were unreal in their size and scope.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened to that bronze? You know, because for me, I think there was a lot of significance that the people had placed in those bronze pillars.
Mm-hmm.
Just the impact that it would have and being overwhelmed at how grand the structure was. And I don't know if it was symbolic in God, you know, humbling the people by bringing down these large pillars and pounding them to dust, because we don't know what they did with the bronze.
Sure.
But this was something that did not get saved.
Right.
It wasn't something that they could repurpose,
even though
they had such significance.
Yeah, that's great. But those weren't essentials in worship. Those were symbols of grandeur. They were symbols of, you know, God's power and establishing a temple and having it built by Solomon. But they weren't necessarily directly related to the worship. So that may be part of the reason why.
Could be.
That's a great point. I hadn't even thought about that. I appreciate you bringing that up. All right. Any other thoughts? I mean, that was great. I appreciate that. I never even thought about that. All right. So they take these articles, and who's involved in weighing them, measuring them, counting them, all those kind of things? Who's involved? Sheshbazzar.
Now, I think that's also God's providence involved in that, because Sheshbazzar didn't go into the warehouse and get these things. They were brought to him by the king.
By the treasurer.
By the treasurer. And it's very important, because treasurers are great people, by the way. They were brought to him by the king. So when they were brought to him by the king, what kind of emphasis did that place on custody and accuracy and precision?
You
better do it right. And you better count twice. Right? So in God's providence, they brought them out to them. And Sheshbazzar was given the idea of, or the responsibility of counting them and making sure of the custody of them. So I think that's very important. And I didn't go through and see what the value of all these things was, but it was probably a pretty good monetary value, with all the gold articles, with all the other articles and so forth. So the king was making obviously he was way beyond wealthy, but he was making a sacrifice based upon what he knew about this God of heaven. So I think that's another part of God's providence. So to what extent does Cyrus help the Jews returning the land? What does he do? We talked about him returning the articles.
He gave them a blank check.
Okay. So he asked, who was going to support the work financially?
Those who stayed behind.
Okay. And what type of offering would the folks give when they arrived? We'll see at the beginning of chapter 2. He demanded that they give a free will offering, correct?
That's so conversation of terms,
isn't it? Right, that's right. It's like being voluntold to do something, right?
Yeah.
But when the king gave an edict about a certain process or a certain item that you're supposed to fulfill, that really brings it up on the scale of importance, doesn't it? And they were still under his rule. He was still in charge of the empire. And so his rule spread throughout the entire empire. And when he told you, I want you to take this 1,000-mile journey, and when you get there, I want you to give a free will offering to support the worship, that held sway because he was still in charge of the empire. And I think that's another thing we see about God's influence and so forth. What is another thing that we see as a possible providential thing in this scenario? Who set the first example of giving?
Well, it was Cyrus.
Cyrus did. So if the king is going to give, and the king is telling me to go back and build, I better get involved in the giving as well. So I think that's another thing we see, is God's providence having this gift coming from the king, which obviously wasn't his to give, But he had custody of the articles of God's temple. But he set the example of giving at the very beginning. So I think that's another thing we see in God's providence. Anything else that you saw?
Well, he allowed them to be prosperous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the thing that the prophets told them when they would go into exile.
Mm-hmm.
Because they thought they could put their confidence in the temple and remain. And they thought, we're going to go to this foreign land, to a language we can't understand, to a religion we have no knowledge of.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world are we going to be able to make it? And God said, with my help you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we see evidence here of God fulfilling his promise that if you go, I'm going to allow you to build houses and you're going to have jobs and you're going to be able to raise your kids in a very successful and economic prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what's happened here. And so they have the resources and the means to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Because those poor folks back in Jerusalem that were left behind, they've got nothing to bring to the table.
They had no walls, they had no houses, I mean, nothing.
Yeah.
Very important, very important. Did someone else have a point? I thought I saw a hand or a half hand. Okay. So, we have all these things coming together by God's providence to support this work and encourage all that were going to support the work. So, as we begin this journey, in chapter 2, we have this significant list of names of all the folks who came. And one of the things I told everybody as I started the class is, don't get too caught up in all these lists of names. You know, because there's some of them are very hard to pronounce, and there's some of them are very long, and we'll have those both in Ezra and in Nehemiah. But there's some very important information to be gleaned from this list of names. So, how are the in this list of names in chapter 2, beginning in verse 2, what are the two ways that the Jews are characterized? How are they classified? Sons of?
Sons
of the city. Okay, so they were sons of, and then they were from the city of. So what is the importance of those two types of distinctions? And it comes up quite a bit during the book.
The genealogy would be the genealogy.
Absolutely. If you were the son of, that meant that through your lineage, you would go back to one of the tribes of Israel, whichever one it may be. But if you were from the city of, what did that mean? That's all it meant. That meant you were from that city. And from what we know about history, there were people in the northern kingdom. What had happened to them?
They were dispersed.
Now, there's a possibility that some of them stayed in Palestine or stayed close. We don't know that. But we know that as we read further, the ones who made the major contribution to the temple were Judah and Benjamin. So obviously they're from the southern kingdom. But if there were others in other cities around them in the area that wanted to contribute, then they could contribute as well. And they, you know, obviously it would be a great joy when some of those Jews have been dispersed by being taken over by the Assyrians to be able to support the temple being rebuilt. And I think it's also interesting as we look further in the book of Ezra, Ezra takes his lineage all the way back to Aaron. And he says, I'm a son of Aaron. A son of a son of a son of a son. But I'm a son of Aaron. So he establishes his genealogy all the way back to Aaron, which is very important as well. And we'll talk about that as we go along, how important that is. So the sons of individuals and the men of whatever city, what controversy came up later on in the chapter?
Were the men wanting to be part of the
Mm-hmm.
They went back to the genealogy, they couldn't find
it. Right.
They were not allowed.
Right. So they said, hey, listen, we want to be part of this deal. We're with you. And we want to be part of the priesthood. And we want to be part of the ones who are doing this work to reestablish God's house, which, you know, I mean, obviously it was a temple where they went. It wasn't God's house because he's not containing the house. But, so what happened to those people who couldn't prove their genealogy?
Disqualified.
And they were unclean. And they were segregated because they were unclean. Now, what's the application to that for us? Yeah, I think there's a bunch of them, but what are some of the applications?
The one is, this is a generation of people that did not, many of them never even set eyes on the old temple,
mm-hmm.
set foot in this land. This was
sure.
land to them.
Mm-hmm.
They were leaving what was familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got that aspect. What do they use as a benchmark, or what do they use to be able to provide a standard for how we are going to conduct ourselves?
Right.
Well, they had it. They had the Word of God. And they probably had individuals who understood and knew the Word of God to be able to say, this is how this order is going to go about.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'm sure they were reminded of the fact that they failed to do this when they were there. So they could say, well, my grandfather, you know, lived in a time where they abandoned God's law.
Mm-hmm.
They embraced paganism. They embraced all this ungodliness where
mm-hmm.
anyone could serve as a priest,
mm-hmm.
especially in the north.
Sure.
And they said, this is what led us to exile. This
mm-hmm.
is what led us to all this destruction, and we're rebuilding on this,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to do this God's way now.
Exactly. And they understood the problems with deviating from God's law. They understood the consequences of that.
Yeah, what it wasn't to the Romans that all the needs and papers and everything was destroyed, so they can't go back now and figure out what's going on.
Right. All those records are gone.
At this time, they still had they knew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had some kind of way of figuring out they were of this family.
Mm-hmm. So what's the lesson for us from that? From observing their behavior? Would it have been more convenient just to say, okay, yeah, you know, the Levites haven't had anything to do for 70 years. They've kind of dispersed throughout the land. Yeah, come on. Would it have been more convenient and more logical to do that? Do you think?
It would have been easier.
But
God said no.
Right. God says this is the way it's done. And when he commanded Moses the law, he said, do everything according to the pattern I gave you. Not use some judgment and see if it works best. So what about us today? What do we do with the New Testament? What's our application?
Follow the pattern.
Mm-hmm. God says that you need to be baptized
right.
to forgive your sins in faith and obedience. I don't know how that works. I have no idea how that works. But I know that's God's pattern and that's God's way. And we're told to meet on the first day of the week. It doesn't say 9, it doesn't say 9:30, it doesn't say 10. You know, we're told to meet and observe the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. So we need to be very careful with how we apply God's Word. Now, if there's judgment to be had, we exercise judgment. But if there's something that is clear, unambiguous, we need to do those things. And do them diligently. Because, as Danny mentioned, the consequences of not doing them was disastrous to their forefathers. And it will be even more disastrous to us from our eternal salvation standpoint. Okay? So they couldn't be part of the priesthood, and they were excluded because they weren't of the right tribe and so forth. They couldn't prove it. So we have these 50,000 people moving down the road, going to Jerusalem, and they're going through hostile territory all the way through. What kept them safe?
Cyrus
and Phoenix, yes. But more importantly,
God.
Because this was them helping to bring about God's purpose. And he was going to give them success, just like he gave Cyrus success to be the world leader and the world ruler. He was now going to give these individuals success. And as we go through the book of Ezra and Nehemiah,
we'll see that this protection of the empire is reestablished and re-emphasized throughout those books. And even though some of the enemies, we'll talk about this, kind of sheltered the truth a little bit in their letter, they were found out later on. Because Cyrus's edict was still in the archives.
Well, Cyrus's edict was really God's edict.
Right, absolutely. Because God stirred him to do it. Absolutely. All right. So we see them finally arrive in Jerusalem. And what do they do when they get there? Down at the back half of chapter 2, the last few verses.
An offering.
Okay. They made an offering. But before they made the offering, what else did they do?
It seems like they went straight to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. So what does that tell us about priorities? God's work and God's worship has to be the priority, no matter what else is going on. You've just traveled 1,000 miles through enemy territory. You may have lost some people along the way. You may have, as Danny mentioned, left everything you knew back in Babylon. Just like Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees and God said, go out. And so he went. But he was following God's will and following God's purpose to bring about eventually the Messiah into the world. And that's the only thing that matters. All the rest of history is just kind of background. Bringing God's Messiah into the world is the purpose of it all. And our lives need to be dedicated to that as well. We need to make sure that our life is aligned with that Messiah. And our life is aligned with what He told us to do as our King. Yeah, Danny?
You know, it had to have solidified their faith at that moment when they saw that.
Mm-hmm.
But you can imagine these people going, never seeing any of this, only being told of the stories, mm-hmm. only reading in the scriptures of what God had done to bring about this devastation and destruction, and then to lay their own eyes and see what God accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how that had to just, that had to ground them to realize this is the real deal.
Mm-hmm. And this is the true God.
Yeah.
This is the one God. The only God. And I think that's a very important lesson because, as you said, this was all new. This is all new territory, a new thing that we've been involved in. And as you said, as we get to building the temple, some of the old men who saw the old one had a comparison, but they didn't. This is all new. This is God bringing us back to His temple. Okay? Remember, on Sunday, Lord willing, we'll do lessons 3 and 4. And it's kind of a continuous story, so it kind of works together. So, what would you guys summarize this? How would you guys summarize this chapter in one word? Or 2 words? Sure, I'll give you 3.
Providence
of God. Absolutely. And you know, the providence of God is one of those things that's much easier viewed from the back to the front than the front to the back. But that's where our faith comes in. Our faith has to come in that God still rules in the nations of the world. Now, what's going on right now? I don't understand. But God does. And He knows. And He knows what the purpose is going to be of all these things that are happening now. Maybe many years from now. So, great class, good commentary. I appreciate it. Lessons 3 and 4 on Sunday morning, Lord willing. And we'll go from there. Thanks, everybody. Oh, one other thing. If any of you guys would like to have a Microsoft Word copy of the lesson so you can kind of fill in and put notes and stuff like that, please let me know. My email is in the directory, and I'll send you a Word version so you can, if you want to put stuff in. If you want to scribble like I do, you're all good. Thank you.
Thank you.